From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Julia Butterfly will join us from atop Luna, a giant redwood in Northern California, where she has sat for more than 2 years. We'll also speak with a Native American from Minneapolis who's been fighting the clearing of sacred land and the cutting down of trees for the construction of a new highway to the largest mall in the United States, the Mall of America. Also today, the U.S. returns the Panama Canal to Panama, and the latest on the Congo and Sierra Leone. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A former beat cop who brutalized a prisoner in New York in a grimy precinct bathroom has been sentenced to 30 years behind bars, a punishment his victim calls a clear message that no one is above the law. Justin Volpe fought back tears during the 2.5-hour hearing yesterday in federal court, reading from a handwritten statement he apologized to his victim, Abner Louima. Volpe rammed a broomstick into Louima's rectum in a police station bathroom in 1997 after arresting and handcuffing the 30-year-old security guard. Police said Volpe mistakenly thought Louima had punched him from behind during an earlier melee outside a Brooklyn nightclub. Louima, who addressed the court during the sentencing, did not ask the judge for any specific punishment, although prosecutors had pushed for a life sentence. The Pentagon kept nuclear weapons on Japanese soil after World War II, despite Tokyo's opposition to the development or presence of such arms. This according to a report by a group of American scientists. Citing an unnamed Japanese source, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists said the United States stored the weapons on Chichijima, some 500 miles southeast of the Japanese mainland, and Iwo Jima, 760 miles south-southeast of Tokyo. The article posted on the publication's website said the two islands became nuclear bases in the 1950s and that Chichijima continued to house warheads with their nuclear material until 1965. Actual nuclear weapons were pulled from Iwo Jima at the end of 1959. In this news from Spain, former Spanish government officials went on trial today in a politically explosive case in which they faced charges of involvement in a dirty war against Basque separatists in the 1980s. The seven defendants, including an ex-security chief and a Civil War general who served under Socialist Prime Minister Felipe González, are accused in connection with the murder and kidnapping of two suspected members of the separatist guerrilla group ETA. The case, the second trial stemming from the dirty war investigation, comes just months before general elections, when the Socialist Party is struggling to clean up its image after a series of corruption scandals which contributed to its 1996 defeat. This news from California. A Cambodian immigrant is suing two Silicon Valley companies, claiming they fired him for refusing to do extra work at home for below the minimum wage. The lawsuit follows a state labor department decision in July to investigate whether Silicon Valley high-tech companies pay Asian immigrants low wages to assemble electronic parts at home. Kam Sun Mao alleged that his former employer, Topline Electronics in San Jose, forced him to work at home at night and on weekends after his daily 8-hour shifts. Mao says he was paid less than minimum wage, sometimes as little as $5 for 3 hours of labor, as he built and repaired power supplies that go into computers. From Louisiana, negotiators work today to persuade five armed Cubans frustrated with their incarceration to release two deputies and a warden from the St. Martin Parish jail. The hostages were taken in the uprising that began shortly after 4 yesterday afternoon as the detainees left an exercise area. A fourth hostage, a deputy sheriff, was released after 6 hours of negotiations. From Baltimore, a criminal investigation has begun to determine whether guards at three boot camps for juvenile delinquents committed child abuse. A team of child abuse investigators and state police detectives have questioned 108 juveniles and 87 staff members at the camps. It was common for camp guards to, quote, push, shove, grab, and generally manhandle youths when they first arrived at the state-run camps in the mountains of Garrett County in western Maryland. This according to the chief of Maryland State Police detectives, who said some instances of violence appeared to be systematic. Maryland state law defines child abuse as any physical pain or injury sustained by a child as a result of, quote, cruel or inhumane treatment or a malicious act by a caregiver, parent, or guardian. Switzerland has frozen $550 million in bank accounts belonging to the late Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha, his family members, and entourage in a money laundering investigation. Geneva's chief cantonal prosecutor told Reuters the funds were frozen at a dozen banks, seven of them in Geneva, Switzerland's secretive private banking club. And the UN War Crimes Tribunal today sentenced Goran Jelicic, a Bosnian Serb former camp guard, to 40 years in prison for the murder and torture of Muslims in the spring of 1992, the harshest sentence the court has handed down so far. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the African nation of the Congo, a rebel group has lost a northwestern town to President Laurent Kabila's troops and will now tighten ranks with two other rebel factions to try to prevent further defeats. This according to a rebel leader. Jean-Pierre Bamba said his Ugandan-backed Congolese liberation movement, Los Nkanya, 465 miles northeast of the capital, Kinshasa, during fighting Sunday that left 119 government soldiers and two rebels dead. Bamba said his movement would join two other rebel groups and talks on Thursday to try to improve military cooperation. The rebel groups are backed by Rwanda and Uganda. Both the government and the rebels have regularly accused each other of ceasefire violations since they completed a peace accord in August that also calls for the deployment of UN peacekeepers, the withdrawal of foreign troops, and a national debate to lay the groundwork for democratic rule in Congo. The peace accord was also signed by Rwanda and Uganda, who back the rebels, and Kabila's allies from Zimbabwe, Angola, and Namibia. Last week, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Richard Holbrooke, warned during a tour of African capitals that no U.N. peacekeepers will deploy in Congo until the ceasefire takes hold, and that warring parties name a neutral mediator to start talks on Congo's future. So far, the rebels and Kabila have been unable to agree on a mediator. We're joined right now by Horace Campbell. He is a professor of African studies at Syracuse University in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Campbell.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you explain further for us what is happening right now in the Congo?
Well, the Congo is coming out of 100 years of plunder, genocide, violence, war, and the will for peace by the Congolese people. And I think the changes that are going on all over Africa have been very dramatic. And the Congolese people are finding out painfully that armed conflict and armed struggles are not the way to solve the political question. The values in the Congolese society that were corrupted first by the Belgians, King Leopold, then by Mobutu, and this tradition was carried on within the political culture by Kabila. These corruption of the basic values of life and devaluing the human lives in Africa, which has been set in motion, needs correction. And the attempt to correct this by different political forces, armed and unarmed, have reached a point where the Congolese people want to move in a new direction. And the difficulty in moving this direction is that the transition is always very painful and slow. However, what we should do is to point to the positive aspects of the transition. And that positive aspect is the reality that on July 10th, all of the parties were signatories to a Lusaka peace agreement. And this peace agreement was a major step forward in breaking those values that I spoke about. And I think it's important that we accentuate the positive aspects of this peace process and why this peace process came into being.
But Professor Campbell, what about the precedent of having other countries like Rwanda backing, and Uganda backing, an invasion of the Congo?
Well, I think that part of the responsibility of the media and persons like yourself is the kind of language that is used to communicate the reality of what's going on in the Congo. The use of the term invasion is the term that has been used by Kabila to determine the fact that citizens of the Congo, and these citizens, although they're divided into different liberation movements, were moved to take up arms because the government of Kabila had foreclosed all forms of parliamentary, democratic, and nonviolent opposition to his government. So the fact that Kabila uses the term invasion does not necessarily mean that it's an invasion, because an invasion suggests that the Ugandans and Rwandans have formed some organizations to invade the Congo. Kabila never suggested that the support that he had from Uganda and Rwanda was an invasion when there was an attempt to remove Mobutu, and this attempt was successful. At that time, the whole of Africa saluted Rwanda and Uganda for taking the initiative in ridding Africa of the kind of government that supported genocide and tolerated those who harbored those who committed genocide. So that Kabila, who himself unleashed the forces from Rwanda that committed genocide, is using the language of the invasion is not at all helpful in terms of understanding. And when the media, some a progressive program such as Democracy Now, use the term rebels for an audience in the United States of America to characterize the ideas of Wamba Diawamba, who's speaking of ideas of emancipatory politics, how the Congolese people can move out of this quagmire of kleptocracy, theft, genocide, how can they move to a new direction of tolerance, politics of inclusion, the collective leadership, the security of the people, and the reconstruction of the people of the Congo. The fact that the left in this country is not aware of the ideas that are coming forward about the politics of emancipation is a testament of the lack of knowledge of what's going on in Africa in this country. I think that the questions of genocide, the question of corruption of the political culture, we're not talking about corruption in terms of money, just the corruption in terms of the values in relation to human life. It is a real deficit in this country when we are not able to point to the sections of society that are moving towards a new direction. I would want to use a similar parallel just to talk about invasion. When South Africa was fighting a war of liberation, the South African government always pointed to other people to say that they were harboring people invading South Africa. Every liberation movement in Africa needed a rear base from which to operate. And in the case of the Congo, the rear base for the Congolese liberation movements are Uganda and Rwanda. It so happens that Uganda and Rwanda also have legitimate security concerns insofar as those who committed the genocide in Rwanda in 1994 escaped to the Congo and are still being supported by the government of the Congo. So there are legitimate internal and external reasons why there are liberation movements from the Congo operating from Rwanda and Uganda.
We're talking to Professor Horace Campbell. He teaches African American Studies and African Politics at Syracuse University. As we look at the Congo and the surrounding area, and also want to talk about Sierra Leone as well. But before we do that, what about Burundi, Professor Campbell, which looks like it could be on the verge of something along the lines of what we saw in Rwanda in 1994?
Unfortunately, this is the case. And again, we need to see how all of these things are interrelated. The extremist elements who preach the politics of ethnicity, elements who preach politics of genocide, on both sides of the political spectrum in Burundi, they want to militarize the situation to the point where there is another genocide. In fact, the genocide in Rwanda is directly linked to the extremist elements in Burundi who killed the prime minister in 1993. But I think this is why we need to be more informed about what's going on. Since 1996, when there was a coup d'etat in Burundi, President Nyerere, former president of Nyerere of Tanzania, took on the painstaking task of trying to bring about the kind of negotiations that would bring peaceful resolution to the problem of the Burundi, where the extremists and the militarists on both sides would be isolated. This work of Nyerere has been opposed by France, has been opposed by the Pentagon, the elements of the Pentagon who want to create something called an African Crisis Response Initiative, where they think that there's a military solution to the political problems of Burundi. President Nyerere passed away in October. But since he passed away in October, the former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, has taken on the task of continuing the role of President Nyerere in being the mediator. And I think this is a major testament to the fact that Africa takes itself very seriously in solving these internal problems. And Africa does not see their problems as unique. They see their problems as part of the international problem, the legacies of colonialism, militarism, and the Cold War. And in this particular case, Nelson Mandela is not only interested in working for peace in Burundi. Some of your audience may not know that there is going to be a meeting in Washington this week between Israel and Syria on the peace negotiations on the Golan Heights. The donkey work for these negotiations had been carried out by President Nelson Mandela of South Africa. So while the world would stand aside and cast aspersions about what's going on in Africa, Africans are concerned about peace in all parts of the world. And the kind of magnanimity which is shown by Nelson Mandela in South Africa in saying that we want truth, reconciliation, and peaceful resolution in South Africa, they're doing the same thing in Burundi. And I think what is needed is more resources from the international community to support the peacekeeping efforts of Mandela and the Julius Nyerere Foundation in Tanzania, so that countries such as France does not go in and support the militarists, because the French Minister of Cooperation went to Burundi to say they will then start supporting the Burundi government, where the Nyerere Foundation was saying that there should be no international support to this government until they came to a peaceful resolution of the situation. So I think that the situation is moving rapidly in Africa, where elements such as the former president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, and Nelson Mandela, in conjunction with the Organization of African Unity, are taking matters into their own hands. So the kind of gloom and doom situation which is presented to the U.S. media to demonize Africans is really falling behind the mold. I want to use an example to show how the media treats the situation in Africa. If I can come back to the Congo for a second.
I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 minute because we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking with Professor Horace Campbell from Syracuse University. He's professor of African American Studies and African Politics. And we're talking about the Congo. We're talking about Burundi. We're talking about overall African politics. And then we're going to, for a moment, talk about Sierra Leone and the UN peacekeepers that have just been brought in there. Sierra Leone having produced more refugees than perhaps anywhere in the world. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with Professor Horace Campbell of Syracuse University, Professor of African American Studies and African Politics, you were just going back, Professor Campbell, to the Congo.
Thank you very much. I wanted to come back to the experience of Nelson Mandela and working for peace in Syria and Israel and the work that he did and see why this devolves some responsibilities to citizens of this country as far as peace is concerned in the Congo and in relationship to genocide in this whole region. In July, there was a peace agreement that was signed in Lusaka. It called for the United Nations peacekeeping force to go into the Congo. It called for the creation of a joint military commission which would oversee the withdrawal of all forces, that is not only Rwanda and Uganda, but Zimbabwe, Uganda, and Angola. It called for the establishment of mechanism for the disarming of the Interahamwe, those who committed genocide. It called for the location, identifying, and disarming of all groups that are armed in the Congo. And it called for the establishment of a national dialogue. Now, since July, the Joint Military Commission has been working diligently to establish the framework for peace. Since July, they have been meeting, attempting to come to an agreement on who the facilitator would be for the national dialogue. I'm pleased to say that today and tomorrow, the Organization of African Unity will have a meeting in Addis Ababa where they'll be discussing Kwame Masisi from the former president of Botswana, to be the facilitator. So that the African peoples take this question of peace in the Congo very seriously. And I think that the Holbrooke and the State Department have to fall into line with what's going on. This idea of posing threats to Africa, the UN will not do this, the UN will not do that, they will not deploy peacekeepers, those kinds of threats does not augur well for the promotion of the peace process, because the United States of America cannot go forward without taking some responsibility for the militarization of this region in their support for Mobutu Sese Seko and Jonas Savimbi in Angola. The whole militarization in this region is born in relationship to the Cold War. And what I would want to say is that it's only been 5 months since we've had this July accord, and the OAU and the mediators are working very hard to set it in motion. The left in this country at least should support the efforts towards peace. I remember when the when the Irish Good Friday Accord was signed in Ireland in 1998. It was signed in April. 20 months later, they were able to move to the stage of decommissioning weapons and trying to get the dialogue going on in Ireland. The media never went about in saying, well, the Irish Peace Accord is going down, the IRA is a rebellious group. The media supported the efforts of Senator Mitchell in the attempts to get peace. What the left and the media needs to do in this country is to support President Nelson Mandela, support Kwame Nkrumah, support the OAU, and support those elements that want to arrest Jonas Savimbi as a war criminal, because the role of Jonas Savimbi and those elements from the United States, South Africa, and the diamond industry that are still supporting him, those are the elements that are blocking peace. It's not because of some innate wish towards violence by the African people.
Professor Campbell, let's touch on Sierra Leone. We'll certainly have a fuller discussion later. But before we move on to Panama, in a historic moment today, as the Panama Canal is handed back to the Panamanians from the United States, Sierra Leone, a story, a country that gets almost no coverage. And when you look at the level of coverage the refugees got, for example, out of Kosovo, and yet you look at the level of the refugee problem in Sierra Leone, it's very clear what the bias of the media is.
Yes. Again, we have to support the efforts towards peace in Sierra Leone. What unites Sierra Leone and the Congo? What is it that brings both of them together? What brings both of them together is the role of diamonds and militarism in Africa. Again, in Sierra Leone, there was a peace accord that was signed in July. And this peace accord said that the 45,000 persons who were involved in fighting against the government, they were in an organization called the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front. And that's why one has to step back from the celebration of armed conflict as a way of solving problems. Because these people signed the agreement, but the diamond dealers in Antwerp, Belgium, which is the world's largest market for rough diamonds, they imported from Liberia 8.3 million carats of diamonds, when Liberia only produces 60,000 carats of diamonds. Where does the other 7 million carats came from? They came from the areas in Sierra Leone where the rebels have control. And the diamond dealers in Israel, Antwerp, and New York have a direct link to supporting and finding arms back to these people. Now, one of the problems with the way in which the State Department views Africa is that it views Africa that they're basically tribal savages, and therefore they'll always be fighting. So in this peace accord that was signed, it did not seek to bring to justice those elements of the RUF that went around cutting off people's hands, violating women, raping, and carrying out acts of violence and violation in the countryside. This kind of thinking is not going to help the peace process. They cannot be peace and reconciliation, reconciling the ordinary citizens of Sierra Leone with those who carried out the most heinous violence. I think this is something we must move from. The next point that you raised was on the question of refugees. Again, we have the double standard of the U.S. government and the State Department, the United Nations. In Kosovo, they were spending at least $1 per refugees per day. $1. In Africa, it ranges from 20 to 30 cents. And the idea of refugees is that refugees are refugees when they are in European countries, such as Kosovo and Bosnia. But in Africa, the United Nations do not develop the resources to be able to help those Africans. And what we need is in January, when the United States of America takes over as chairperson of the Security Council for January, Holbrooke said that this will be the month for Africa. It cannot be the month for Africa without some dramatic changes in the United States of America. In the State Department itself, They have 4 desk officers for Kosovo, but only 1 for Rwanda and the Congo. I think there must be some internal political changes, and I think this is where the media would have a very important role to play in trying to bring more information to citizens of this country when the United States has the chairmanship of is the chairperson of the Security Council in January. Because Holbrook says this will be the UN month for Africa. It cannot be the UN month for Africa without moving away from the ideas of plunder, genocide, and savagery, which is in the public consciousness in the United States of America.
Horace Campbell, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Horace Campbell teaches African American Studies and African Politics at Syracuse University in New York. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go to another issue outside of our borders, intimately connected to the United States. A ceremony is taking place now in Panama, attended by several heads of state, but with the noted absence of President Clinton. Some pundits speculate that he doesn't want to be in Panama for the handover of the Panama Canal because it could damage Vice President Al Gore's campaign. But it has angered Panamanians that the only person who is in Panama, the highest level representative of the United States, is an acting Undersecretary of the State Department. This was noted yesterday in comments by the Panamanian Foreign Minister, Jose Miguel Alemán.
With respect to the significance of the transfer of the Panama Canal and the completion of the Torrijos-Carter treaties,
we're going to go to an interview that I just did with a person in Panama City. In just a minute, but we do want to go back to that comment of Jose Miguel Alemán, who was expressing a great deal of anger yesterday at the fact that not only President Clinton was not in Panama, but Madeleine Albright, who said she'd come, also canceled her visit there. This is the Panamanian foreign minister.
And the feeling I have gotten from the other members of the other countries is that they are disappointed and perplexed.
The foreign minister of Panama. Well, Jimmy Carter is there. The former president is leading the U.S. delegation. Carter set the withdrawal in motion of the United States from Panama in 1977. When he signed treaties relinquishing U.S. control of the waterway by noon on December 31st, 1999. The handover ceremonies today are taking place 2 weeks early to avoid a conflict with millennial celebrations. Built under President Theodore Roosevelt, the Panama Canal opened in August of 1914 and cost thousands of lives to build, mostly of enslaved workers from the West Indies who died of exhaustion, yellow fever, and other illnesses. Early this morning, I got a chance to speak with Panamanian journalist Lemoine Werlein Hayen, who is getting on a bus to go to the diplomatic ceremonies today. And he spoke about the significance of the handover of the Panama Canal.
With respect to the significance of the transfer of the Panama Canal and the completion of the Torrijos-Carter treaties, we really can't overstate the significance of these events for Panama. In the first instance, it represents the culmination of a 100-year struggle on the part of the people of Panama for sovereignty and self-determination, a struggle that unfortunately has, at various times in our history, propelled us into conflict with the United States. We remember very well down here that in 1925, the United States invaded Panama City to crush a general strike, killing 6 protesters and wounding dozens others. In 1964, protesting Panamanian students were attacked by U.S. forces, and in a 3-day conflagration, over 22 Panamanians were killed and over 500 wounded by U.S. soldiers. And then, of course, in 1989, during the invasion ostensibly to overthrow the government of General Manuel Antonio Noriega, over 2,000 innocent Panamanians were killed. So these events that we're seeing now is really the culmination of that struggle and is the vindication for all the people who lost their lives in that struggle. In the second instance, it represents the first time in our nation's history that the Panamanian state will actually control the entire national territory, and the achievement finally, after 95 years of Republican history, of sovereignty. And finally, really it represents an immense set of possibilities for Panama's development, not only in the sense that we now control the canal and the areas around it, and we can now put those areas to Panama's use of Panama's development, but also as just a massive infusion of capital and infrastructure and real estate that had been historically controlled by the United States and now is going to be in Panamanian hands. So again, down here, we really feel that we cannot overstate the significance of these events, and it is truly being greeted in Panama as our second independence.
How did the U.S. get the canal?
The United States gained control of the canal zone area in order to build the canal by way of a treaty with the newly independent Panamanian government in 1903. Historically in Panama, this is known as the treaty that no Panamanian signed, because a French engineer, under the employment of the French Panama Canal Company, who was in Washington, D.C. During the period when Panama was separating from Colombia, he was empowered by the Panamanian government to establish contact with the U.S. government and begin to hammer out the terms of establishing diplomatic relations and so forth. This individual, Juan Felipe Anuvaria, signed a treaty with the United States conceding territory in Panama to the United States to build the canal, but also to control that area as a colonial enclave. And then this treaty was later presented to the Panamanian government as a fait accompli, which, having recently achieved independence and so forth, the Panamanian government was not in a position to protest or to do anything about this treaty.
Lemoyne, I've reached you just before you get on the bus, the media bus, to cover today's events. While you talk about the final handover being the end of the year, December 31st, can you explain what's happening today?
Today they're going to be celebrating the diplomatic ceremony for the transfer of the canal. So we have foreign dignitaries arriving in the country. Former President Jimmy Carter arrived yesterday in Panama. So it's going to be the official ceremony today for the transfer. The actual transfer of the canal is going to happen at 12 noon on December 31st, as stipulated by the Panama Canal Treaties. But with the certain preoccupations with the Y2K and so forth, and the millennium, it was decided that they would move up the diplomatic ceremonies.
I was just listening to the Panamanian foreign minister expressing dismay over the fact that the current Clinton administration has only sent an undersecretary from the State Department. Madeleine Albright was supposed to go, but she canceled today.
Correct. It's really been received as an insult down here, the fact that the Clinton administration did not see fit to either send a high-level delegation such as Albright or for Clinton to come himself. It really, unfortunately, represents a lost opportunity for the United States to try to establish a new relationship with Panama. This would have been a golden opportunity for the United States to sum up its experience in Panama, to attempt to put a positive spin on it, and to attempt to redefine a new relationship. Unfortunately, the U.S. government has squandered that opportunity, and once again, it's left a bad taste in many people's mouths around here.
Can you talk about what you mean by an infusion of capital?
Mm-hmm. Well, the canal, the canal is being transferred to Panama, but along with it, there are 14 military U.S. military bases that have also been transferred to Panama, as well as vast areas around the canal where the infrastructure which supported the canal is. This includes over 147,000 hectares of land, including over 3,000 buildings, including housing stock, office buildings, hospitals, and an airport, in fact. As well as power generation stations and things of this sort. So it really represents a massive infusion of infrastructure and capital into the country, which in many respects is a one-time deal can only have a positive impact on the nation's development.
The way it's being played here in the newspapers is, can the Panamanians deal with it? While there's been resentment of the American presence, can the Panamanians themselves actually run the canal?
That, unfortunately, is the spin that's being put out in the United States, which more than anything reflects a certain chauvinism and arrogance on the part of the U.S. press and the U.S. political establishment. For the better part of the last decade, over 95% of the workforce of the canal has been Panamanian. Currently, 97% of the workforce is Panamanian. So the transfer of the canal is a jurisdictional change in its administration. The fact is, Panamanians have been running the canal for at least 10 years. It has been run with the same efficiency as it was run before. There have been no problems with the maintenance of the canal in these last 10 years. There have been no problems with upgrading and investments in the canal. There have been no problems in investments that the canal has made or in the finances of the canal. Everything has run fairly smooth for the last 10 years, during which time the canal has actually already been in Panamanian hands.
Lemoyne Werlein Hayin, he is a reporter with... he is an independent reporter who is down in Panama right now. He himself is Panamanian, though he does live in San Francisco. He was just getting on the bus when I spoke with him early this morning to go to the diplomatic ceremony where the United States is handing over the Panama Canal to Panama. The official moment that the canal gets handed over is December 31st at noon. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we go up in a tree in Northern California, and we'll go to Minneapolis as well for struggles around forests. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. 2 years ago, on December 10th, 1997, a 23-year-old preacher's daughter climbed 180 feet into the branches of an old-growth redwood, determined to save it from a chainsaw. Since then, Julia Hill, known to her friends as Julia Butterfly, has changed her life. She's also tried to change the way people look at California's old forests through an internet campaign and interviews with reporters around the world. This month, one more thing may be changing. She may be coming down from the tree that she's lived in for the last 2 years and called Luna. We're going to go to Julia Butterfly in just a minute, but first we turn to Pacific Lumber, with whom she has been battling, as many environmentalists have for a number of years. Josh Reese is a spokesperson for Pacific Lumber. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start off by asking what the effect of Julia Butterfly's campaign has been on Pacific Lumber.
To be perfectly honest with you, on our business, none. Ms. Hill has been involved in a tree sit on our private property for the last 2 years. And we have and remain very, very concerned about her safety. She is 180 feet up in the tree. I don't know if you've ever been to that part of California, but the winters there are very, very tough. We're very concerned about her safety. And at the same time, we want her down. But at the same time, we are never going to agree to anything with Ms. Hill unless it addresses two very, very real concerns that we have. And they're concerns that we've expressed to her and her representatives numerous times over the last 2 years. And they're as follows. First, we are never going to agree to anything if Ms. Hill gets out of the tree and then proceeds to participate in or encourage other members, particularly those in her the movement Earth First, of which we believe she is a member, to go back and tree sit on our private property. We're not going to do that. We think it's dangerous. We have people gotten hurt on our property trying to do so. We think it's unfair to our 1,300 employees. It's something we're not going to agree to. And secondly, we are not going to agree to any arrangement with Ms. Hill, which ends up turning into a commercial enterprise. It has become, I think Ms. Hill has become concerned in recent weeks because the press has started to realize that this may be becoming a commercial enterprise for her. She has a book deal. There are promotional videos and T-shirts for sale, which advocate tree sitting on Pacific Lumber's property. There was a rally over the weekend in near where she is engaging in her tree sit, and one of the people at the rally, who is a member of Earth First, started yelling, "Tell them where the money went. Tell them where the money went." So we have some very real concerns that need to be addressed. At the same time, there's this young woman who everybody respects the passion of within our organization, and we want her to be safe.
According to Associated Press, the proposed agreement would have Julia Butterfly and her supporters paying $50,000 to you, Pacific Lumber Company, owners of the property where Luna stands, the tree that she's in return for a logging ban at the tree-sitting site. The money would then be donated to Humboldt State University for forestry research.
Right.
You also want signed statements from Julia that the company hopes will discourage copycat acts. Are these true? Are these the terms?
Look, unlike Ms. Hill, I'm not going to, discuss on the record or leak information regarding what may or may not be on the table. But I think the question you have to ask is, if you are to believe what you read in the press, which is that the tree that she cares so passionately about is to be saved and there is to be a buffer zone, which is something she's advocated for a while, if you are to believe that, then why is she still in the tree? And I think the only conclusion that a lot of people are beginning to draw is because it's become some sort of commercial enterprise for her. I don't know if any of your readers saw the Sacramento Bee editorial of last week. If they didn't, I encourage them to look at it. And what it pointed out was, is they said, quote, "With every less day, this tree sit is looking less purposeful and more commercial." And I think, the fact that we wanted these negotiations to be a private matter. For whatever reason, Ms. Hill or her representatives chose to tell the media that they were going on. And it opened up the floodgates, so to speak, in a way that we never expected. An individual in Humboldt County, where we have our facilities and our timber, has taken out full-page ads over the last week saying, "Don't give in to Julia Hill Pacific Lumber. Don't give in to an eco-terrorist." Our phone lines have been absolutely flooded with people supporting that position. We've gotten more calls along that line than we have letters and calls from her supporters in the last 6 to 9 months. So there are two very, very different opinions here as to what should or shouldn't be done. It's a complicated matter that involves the environment, it involves jobs, it involves law enforcement, it involves private property rights. And the bottom line is, we want Ms. Hill to be safe. She remains free to leave our private property at any time. In the recent weeks, she has described herself as a prisoner of war. A lot of people find that to be deeply offensive at Pacific Lumber. Prisoners of war are individuals who are captured by the enemy during wartime in service of their country. They're not individuals who voluntarily decide to engage in a tree sit.
What do you mean by eco-terrorist?
A lot of people believe that Earth First, of which, again, we believe she is a member, they are the group that organized her tree sit, that holds rallies on her behalf, that holds fundraisers to promote her tree sit, is an eco-terrorist organization. If you look at their website, they advocate positions such as green anarchy, visualize industrial destruction, developers go build in hell. It's an organization that a number of years ago put spikes into trees so when that they would be cut, would harm the people, the honest law-abiding people, who were harvesting those trees when they went into the mill.
Would you stand by calling Julia Butterfly an eco-terrorist?
I don't know whether she is or isn't. I know, though, We believe that, she has a number of colleagues in Earth First. She may be a member of Earth First herself. And they advocate a number of positions which the company does not believe in, nor do the people of Humboldt County believe in.
As a result of what has happened, the tree sit and the amount of attention it's gotten, will Pacific Lumber change its practices? According to Julia, that there have been numerous violations. I believe she says more than 300 violations of the California Forest Practices Act.
Ms. Hill went up in the tree for a number of different reasons, she says. She wanted to save old-growth trees. She wanted to save the Headwaters Forest. Well, the Headwaters Forest has been saved. The largest remaining stand of old-growth trees remaining in private hands in the United States has been purchased.
So would you say her tree setting has been a success?
I don't know whether she contributed to that or not. I think she added a voice to it. I'll give her that.
Do you have some respect for her?
I don't think there's anyone in this organization that doesn't have a respect for her passion about something that she holds very dear to her. But there was something I wanted to mention, which you had talked about as well, which were violations of the law and environmental protections on our property. As a result of the agreement we reached with the government early last year, we now have a remarkable set, the highest set of environmental protections on our property of any timber company in that area of California. We have protections for marbled murrelets, coho salmon, spotted owls, buffer zones along streams, applying sound science to determine where we can and can't harvest to prevent against things like mudslides and landslides. As for the issue of environmental violations, were there a number in the last couple of years? Yes, there were. That is not something we are proud of. We knew it was a problem, and we have put a lot of time and money and effort behind trying to get that to do away with that problem. And I'm not quite sure of the specific number, but I think our violations this year have been reduced close to 90%.
Well, Josh Reese, I want to thank you for being with us of Pacific Lumber, which is the company that owns the land where the old redwood that Julia Butterfly is sitting in stands. I wish you could have gone on with Julia Butterfly, but you wouldn't go on at the same time. So we're going to turn now to Julia Butterfly, who is 180 feet up in an ancient redwood that she calls Luna. Welcome to Democracy Now, Julia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your responses to what Josh Reese, the spokesperson for Pacific Lumber, has said.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I, too, wish that Josh Reese would have gone live with me. When I held a press conference last week, it was only in the effort to try and get the truth as I understand it and see it out to the world, because they have been spreading a lot of misinformation about me. One of the points Josh Reese keeps making to me is a magnifying glass that Maxam Corporation and Pacific Lumber are not doing a very good job of communicating with each other right now, because Josh Reese is based with the Maxam Corporation in Houston, Texas, and then is speaking on behalf of the people at Pacific Lumber. When
Maxam took over Pacific Lumber, right?
That is correct, yes. The CEO of Maxam is Charles Hurwitz, and he took over Pacific Lumber nearly 15 years ago. The point I was wanting to make, I'm sorry, it's a little early out here, is that he has been saying that I leaked details to the press. I really was not interested in getting into a low-level mudslinging match that the company has been engaged in the last week. As many times before that has happened in the 2 years I've been up in this tree, the company has said that I'm lying, and yet I have proof that I'm not. The same with them saying that I brought it to the press first, that I leaked details first. I have documented proof that someone from within Pacific Lumber began leaking both the negotiations and the details of the negotiations into the press long before I ever went public. I, too, recognized how controversial this issue is and have done everything within my power to hear the concerns of Pacific Lumber Maxam Corporation, address them to the best of my ability, and treat them with the dignity and respect that I would ask to be treated in return. And unfortunately, this last week, they have really got involved in trying to attack me and my integrity and do so without giving me the fair opportunity to have my side heard, which is why I then held a press conference.
Julia, what do you feel you've accomplished over the last 2 years on the second anniversary of your tree sitting?
I think the greatest thing that this tree sit has accomplished, number one on a personal level, is that above all else, I know that I can wake up in the morning and hold my head high because I am living my truth and my belief to the best of my ability. And a friend of mine told me just a week or so ago when all of this became public and it became very heated, he said, "Don't worry, Julia. There's an amazing thing about truth. It's like a cork in the middle of the ocean, and no matter how hard they try and push it down, eventually it's going to pop back to the top." And I think that's the most wonderful thing. I think second of all has been that it has reached out into people's consciousness and shifted the way they view the earth and each other. Ultimately, it's our choices that have gotten us to a point where a company is allowed to clear-cut, dump diesel fuel and herbicide spraying onto the land, which poisons the land, the animals, and the people. It is our choices that have led us to the point where 97% of the original redwoods are gone, and yet we are still allowing parts of the last 3% to be cut down. And it is our choices that are going to lead us back to a place of healing and restoration and true sustainability. And for that, I think this tree sit has been successful.
We're talking to Julia Butterfly, who is 180 feet up in a redwood tree. The tree about 15 feet across, more than 18 stories high. Tell us about the mudslide that occurred right near the tree, and that might go to the point about the issue of violations.
Absolutely. The reason this tree sit was begun is not only because this tree has been estimated to be over 1,000 years old, but was actually begun because activists down in that were staying down in the town of Stafford heard cutting on this hillside right next to a mudslide that had originated on a logging road in Pacific Lumber Clear Cut, went rushing down the hill, and by the time it was done, seven families' homes in Stafford were completely destroyed and numerous others were damaged. So when the activists heard cutting happening on the hillside again, they were reasonably appalled and obviously appalled that the company would have not only such a lack of respect for the environment, but a lack of respect for people's very lives. They hiked up this hillside and found that indeed the company was cutting directly adjacent to that mudslide, and that area is where Luna stands. Josh Reese said that he acknowledged the fact that I would like to see this over 1,000-year-old tree in a buffer zone protected and said, "Well, why is she still up there?" I'm still up here because they have not agreed to protect this area. He also said that I'm up here for a commercial venture, which I think is quite sick and sad. I have given everything I have to give for the last 2 years. The only thing I have on a personal level to show for it is food in my belly and clothes on my back. And I wonder if I live in a society where I have to give up even that to prove how much I care about this issue. And I think it's ironic that they're trying to spin it and focus it on a movement making money when, number one, they if they did a little research they would and told the truth, they would notify the public that I am giving 100% of my proceeds from the book away. The book is about outreach. It's not about money. It's about outreach. And every aspect of this movement is about outreach.
And what is the name of your book?
The name of the book is The Legacy of Luna. It will be in stores in April. This company, Pacific Lumber Maxim Corporation, has made millions of dollars off of the backs of workers, off of the environment, and off of violating the law. And I think it's really, really sad that they're now trying to twist it around and make it appear that I'm up here to make money, especially because there's a lot easier ways than freezing through a winter to make money.
Julia Butterfly, I want to thank you for being with us again in a 1,000-year-old giant redwood, her home for the last 2 years. And we said we go to Minneapolis, where a battle to save some trees was lost. We don't have time. We will do that tomorrow with a Mendota Dakota Native American. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Dred Scott Keyes and Robert Knight. And happy birthday to Bernard White. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.